Committee on Education Workforce Development Committee to order. Apologize for being a few minutes late. We're getting some last-minute amendments here on what is likely to be our last meeting of this short session. We've got four bills up today. We're going to start off with House Bill 4016, then go to House Bill 4141, then 4057, and then 4014. So let me open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 4016. If you could give us a quick summary, Administrator Cox.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4016 adds to the list of public and private officials required to report child abuse employees of higher education institutions and public or private organizations providing child-related services or activities to youth groups or centers, scout groups or camps, summer or day camps, survival camps or groups, centers or camps that are operated under the guidance, supervision, or auspices of religious, public or private educational systems or community service organizations, and coach, assistant coach, or trainer of amateur, semi-professional, or professional athlete, if compensated and if athlete is a child, excludes community-based nonprofit organizations whose primary purpose is to provide confidential direct services to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, or human trafficking, allows alternate designated person to receive report of suspected abuse if the designate is the abuser, clarifies that duty to report rests with the individual, not organization for which he or she works.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Gelser. Right. You have a team or solo here?
I believe that I am solo.
Okay.
Chair Half, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sarah Gelser, state representative from House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. I'm happy to be Senator Morse's constituent as well. House Bill 4016 comes to you. It is a bill introduced by the House Education Committee. It passed unanimously out of the House Education Committee and unanimously off the floor of the House. It is really a very simple bill. It simply expands the list of individuals who are required to be mandatory reporters of child abuse to include college and university staff and the staff of youth-serving organizations. And I can provide you with two examples of why we've come to know that this is important to do in the state of Oregon. Many of you are aware of the unfortunate incidents that occurred on a university campus on the East Coast as part of an athletic program, and there were discussions here in Oregon about how that wouldn't happen here because all of our school employees, higher ed employees, are mandatory reporters. We looked into it, and it turned out that the way that we defined it in the statute, that in fact our universities and community colleges were excluded from our definition of school employee. So this would bring on board those colleges and universities, both public and private. You should have at your place a letter from the Oregon Community College Association in support of the bill. I also became aware of the issue because Oregon State University was conducting a work group to look at how they were going to deal with this because of all the kids they have on campus, whether it's athletic programs, music programs, 4-H programs. They really wanted a clear, bright line. The other place that this issue came up in the state of Oregon was a couple of years ago, the ongoing lawsuit around the Boy Scouts. And in this case, you had an organization that had an internal policy about the reporting of abuse, was that you would make that report to someone within the organization, and the policy was to not report out to an outside entity. The unfortunate result of that was that we were not able to intervene quickly enough to help victims of child abuse and to remove perpetrators from very dangerous kinds of situations. So this bill simply says that those individuals who are most likely to be in organizations that are serving children and are employed by those organizations would be required to be mandatory reporters of child abuse. I'll give you a quick example of that. In the House Education Committee, we had testimony from someone that was part of a sleepaway camp, and the question was asked, how do you deal with allegations of abuse right now? And they indicated that they would have a team of people get together, they would talk about it, and then they would decide whether or not to make a call about that. In this case, the The employee, not the volunteer, there are no volunteers that are covered in this. The employee, if they had reasonable suspicion to believe that abuse had occurred, would be required to make that telephone call so that a person with expertise in child abuse assessment and investigation could determine whether or not abuse occurred. You also have at your place, if you have questions about what it means to be a mandatory reporter, we are all mandatory reporters. There's an FAQ there for you. It does not require these mandatory reporters to be able to diagnose abuse or be certain that abuse has occurred. The standard is simply that someone has made a disclosure to you or you are concerned enough that a child is being harmed or that an adult is harming a child. You make that telephone call to law enforcement or DHS. Two other quick things I wanted to put on the record. There was a concern raised about the language in this that for the child caring organizations, it isn't specifically limited to those that have direct care and control of children. That is, in fact, intentional and is consistent with the rest of the statute. If you look at our current statute, every employee of the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Health Authority, the State Commission on Children and Families, the Child Care Division, the Oregon Youth Authority, county health departments, community mental health programs, community developmental disability programs, county juvenile departments, licensed child caring agencies, or alcohol and drug treatment programs, every employee is a mandatory reporter, regardless of whether they see a child during the course of their day. The same is true for school employees. Whether you are working in the business office or you are a classroom teacher, under current law, you are a mandatory reporter. That same would be true in the case of these child caring organizations. And the reason for that is, if we are not making, for instance, the Girl Scout troop leader herself, who is a volunteer, a mandatory reporter, we want to be sure that that person in the office that she goes to for guidance about what to do with that, that's that safeguard that ensures that that report is made. Finally, the one other concern that was raised in the House Ed Committee was about this idea of false allegations of child abuse and that this would increase the number of false allegations of abuse. And numbers were shared about the number of unsubstantiated allegations of abuse in the Department of Human Services each year. It's important to remember that an unsubstantiated allegation is not necessarily a false allegation. In my district, and many of you helped pass Carly's Law a couple of years ago, Carly Sheehan was a 3-year-old girl that was beaten to death by her mother's boyfriend. Twice in the 9 months prior to her death, she was the subject of child abuse investigations that ended in an unsubstantiated allegation finding. The same is true for a little girl in the Portland area named Oleander that many of you may have read about. In that case, adults witnessed the abuse, talked about it afterwards. She was the subject of an allegation of abuse that was unsubstantiated. Those were not false allegations. There just needed to be more reports so that more investigations could have been done so that these children's lives could have been saved. And that is ultimately what this bill is about. It's making people safer, and I hope you will join us in passing this bill. And I'm happy to answer questions. Stacey Ayers from DHS is here if you have questions about the mechanism of child abuse reporting.
Thank you, Senator George.
Representative, thank you very much for bringing the bill. So I just want to make sure I understand how we're doing this. So private institution has a janitor. We're making them a mandatory reporter, as I understand your testimony. And then are they then also a 24/7 mandatory reporter or just in the environment that they're working in? And are they then obligated, like we are, to be 24/7 mandatory reporters because they work for this private institution as a janitor and...
Correct. Chair Haas, Senator George, this just goes right into the current child abuse reporting statute. So, yes, they would be constant mandatory reporters, just as we are and just as janitors in school districts and the janitors that work in the building down at the Department of Human Services building are today.
Just a quick follow-up. I guess I'm just... Are we sure we have training to kind of put this obligation on folks? I mean, are we comfortable that these institutions are going to be able to train their folks of what this obligation actually is? And I guess I just want to have that discussion a little bit on the record.
Of course. Chair Haas, Senator George, thank you for that question. There's two answers to it. First, yes, the training is easily available. The Department of Human Services makes available on its website a very short video that individuals can watch that kind of talk them through how to make that phone call to get assistance for a child. The second piece is because this is limited to employees, you can do this very easily during an employee orientation, and it certainly is something that is currently handled by all of these organizations, public and private, that are currently covered by the child abuse reporting statute.
Thank you.
Senator Hayward.
Just to clarify, Representative Gelser, first of all, thank you. As Senator George said, I really appreciate your bringing this piece of legislation forward. like many of us, I have children involved with club sports. And this would apply to the coaches. If we pay fees to cover the training that our children get in those. Would that count as the kind of person who would be then become a mandatory reporter under this bill?
Chair Haas, Senator Steiner Hayward, thank you for that question. And the answer is, it depends. I would have preferred that the bill covered all youth athletics. Instead, it only covers those that are directly compensated. As you probably know from club sports, sometimes you're paying the fee and it's covering the organizational and tournament fees. Sometimes we pay our coaches. If the coach is receiving compensation for coaching youth, then yes, that person is a mandatory reporter. If they are receiving no compensation for their coaching or their assistant coaching or their other athletic service, they would not be. However, they would not be prohibited from reporting, and hopefully anyone that is concerned that abuse is taking place will make that call.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Representative, one last question, because I want to talk about this volunteer issue, and I just want to make sure I get this clear. The very last part of the bill, there's a we talk about not having the volunteers covered by this. And in Section 11, Subsection 4, there's a discussion about volunteers, and I don't quite understand what that phrase is. Just kind of make sure I understand that.
Sure. Chair Haas, Senator George, thank you for that question. We did talk about whether to pull that word volunteer out or leave it in. This was added to the bill when volunteers were still in. The reason we left it in is that an individual may be volunteering for an organization and they may be a mandatory reporter, not by virtue of their association with that organization, but for some other purpose. For instance, a dentist is a mandatory reporter. That dentist may be volunteering to provide free dental screenings at the Boys and Girls Club in Corvallis, which happens here. We want to make sure that it's clear that that volunteer, that the organization does not have liability for the actions of a volunteer that may be a mandatory reporter under some other premise.
Gotcha. Okay. You understand why I was a little confused.
Yes.
Right, so
yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Roger Williams.
Chair Haas, committee. For the record, my name is Roger Williams. I'm the legislative coordinator for the OSH, for the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network. There was quite an extensive conversation on the other side, as you're probably aware. And so I just wanted to ask you to respect the compromise that was made over there. It was well discussed. I would like to I'm going to say this is a private citizen changing hats, not as a representative of OSHA Network. It occurred to me when the bill was first drafted, it limited employees and volunteers to those who actually worked with kids. Somewhere during the process, that limitation was dropped. So, for instance, I work for a local government. I'm an IT guy. That local government has a parks program. Some of the employees work with kids. They're way over here. I'm over here. I never see the kids. We also have, like many businesses, a child care center. I'm never around them. I may walk out on my way by, but because all employees are covered, now all of the people in my organization, because there's a child care facility, are covered. And that seems to me kind of like it's the tail wagging the dog. And it doesn't seem... In my view, it's not good public policy to have somebody subject to legal responsibilities on a factor as random as they work for an employer that has a child care facility for their employees' children. So I would appreciate it if you would think about that issue. I'm not... That's it. Thanks.
Okay. Questions? Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Williams, I appreciate your concern. I guess I would ask you a question and then make a comment, if I might. I guess I'd ask you what your concern is about being a mandated reporter. Why does that bother you? I'm not trying to put you on the spot, sir, but you brought the point up, and I'm trying to understand your concerns at this point.
Chair Haas, Senator Hayward. Personally, I don't have a problem. It just seems really weird to have that type of legal path to impose responsibilities on people, and that's all my concern is about.
So the comment I would offer, as a physician, I've been a mandated reporter since I started medical school over 25 years ago, and I can tell you that sometimes it's convenient to have a law to hide behind. Reporting child abuse is difficult and painful, especially if you have to inform the parent that you're going to report something, and having the law behind you to say, I don't have a choice. I'm going to get in trouble with the law. I'm going to lose my license. In your case, I could lose my job or whatever it is, can be a buffer for you. And I understand your concern, and I understand the desire to not have the government intrude too much. But on the other hand, I think we're all highly committed to protecting children. And as Representative Gelser pointed out, sometimes a person in your position may be the one who hears from another volunteer or in a by-the-way fashion that this is going on, and having you have that shield, they don't want to report, having you have that shield saying I have to, gives you some freedom in some funny ways, just by my personal experience.
Chair Haas, could I respond? Sure. Chair Haas, Senator Hayward. you didn't hear my testimony on the other side.
No, sir.
I made it clear that like every moral person in the state, when I hear about things like what happened at Penn State, I'm really angered. There would be no hesitation in my mind to report something that I thought needed to be reported.
Mr. Chair, if I may. Thank you, Mr. Williams. I appreciate being. I was not saying anything about you specifically, because you made it very clear when you responded to my first question that it wasn't you specifically. It was an overarching concern. So I should have used the word one instead of you. I was being imprecise in my language, and I apologize for that. I assumed that as a person of faith, you would take that responsibility very seriously, as do most of us, regardless of our faith or beliefs in general. But there are some people who might find it challenging. And for them, having the power of the law on their side to give them that buffer, that protection, might be very helpful. That's all I was trying to point out.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Jason Carlisle, Dana Hepper.
Shall I go first, Mr. Chair?
Please. Me?
We've never met before.
Hi, nice
Jason
to meet
Carlisle.
You. Dana
Hi.
Hepper.
Hi.
My name's Dana Hepper. I'm the Advocacy Director with Stand for Children. I'll jump in. Stand for Children supporting House Bill 4016, the expansion of mandatory reporting laws to additional personnel responsible for youth at universities and community organizations. STAND leaders actually voted unanimously to support this legislation when I brought it to them, and felt it was incredibly reasonable. And I think you heard already that 18 states already have every adult in the state responsible for being a mandatory reporter of child abuse when they see it. And I just wanted to share really briefly my own personal experience as a teacher. When I was a teacher, I was a mandatory reporter in Oregon. And what we found is time and time again, one report of suspected child abuse is not enough. What often needs to happen is you get an inkling, you get a sense, maybe there's something wrong in this, maybe there's something wrong in the child's home situation or another situation in their life. You call DHS, you make a report. It's not enough for them to go out and actually visit the child, talk to them, talk with the family. So you've got to make another report the next time you see something wrong. And what really needs to happen is you build a case in most of the circumstances that I dealt with when I was a teacher, and I would say about 25% of my class, we had at least one report on over the course of the year. And most of the time, it took multiple reports before there was enough there to make it worth visiting that child and finding out what was going on and seeing whether they were safe and whether they needed to be more safe. And so our sense is, my personal sense and the sense of Stand for Children, is that the more people we have responsible for making these claims, the better chance we'll have at keeping kids safe. We got to build that case, so that's where we're supportive. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, Jason Carlisle, Linn County District Attorney. I'm here for the ODAA here today. The early iterations had some technical problems we had some difficulties with. Those have been resolved with the amendments and the like, and now we're in a position to support the bill. Just wanted to make that clear to you.
Okay. Appreciate that.
There were some hitches in the get-along, but I think we're there.
There almost always is.
You want to know about hitches and get-alongs. We have a bill coming up. Any questions for either of these two?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That's all who signed up to testify, and so we are in a work session, Senator Morris, on House Bill 4016A.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'm pleased to move House Bill 4016A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves House Bill 4016A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Can clerk call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Morse?
Aye.
Chair Pavin?
Aye. The measure passes. Senator Steiner Hayward, you did such a phenomenal job today. Would you carry this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be honored.
I'm going to close the work session and public hearing on 4016 and open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 4141. Administrator Cox, if you could give us a quick rundown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4141 directs Governor and State Workforce Investment Board to convene an advisory committee to study workforce development issues and impediments to job creation and report findings to the interim legislative committees by November 15, 2012. Clarifies advisory committee is a subcommittee of the Standing Workforce Investment Board and adds information on current impediments to job creation in Oregon to the Governor's report. Sunsets upon convening of the 2013 legislative session.
Thank you. Elena Gunney and Brian Craig, both here. Step forward.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Ilana Guinea. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We are supportive of this bill. We think that it is high time that we really take a good look at our workforce system and make sure that it is working for Oregonians. Right now we have an incredibly complicated system. A lot of money comes in from different places. A lot of money goes out through different programs. There are a lot of different requirements we're trying to meet, a lot of goals we're trying to meet, and they don't always line up in the way that they should. We are asking in this bill for the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which is a board that already exists. This is not the creation of a new work group, which I know is important to a lot of people. We are asking that they take a look at the system, that they figure out what we really need to be doing in this system, and that we make sure that the ways that we're using the limited amount of resources we have coming in really match up with the goals that we're trying to achieve. This is something that we could have done a long time ago. I think it's even more important to do now, even more timely, given that we do have dwindling resources for things like this, a lot of people who are out of work, and an economy that is starting to recover slowly with employers who need well-trained people coming into the workforce. We hope that you pass this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions about it that you may have.
All right.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Krieg. I'm here today representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. The executive director of PMCA, Frank Wall, sits on the Clackamas County Work Board. He wasn't able to join us today, but he wanted to make sure that we were on record knowing that they were very supportive of this, as are most all of my industry clients we've had discussions with about this. Better coordination, prioritization, and clarity is needed in our long-term workforce development in the state, and I think this bill would go a long ways to helping organize that in a more in a better way. We need long-term planning, and there was a lot of discussion in the previous committee for this about the downturn in the economy and needing to work with workers to transition to new jobs and things. But those of you who were here 6 to 8 years ago will probably remember there was a lot of industry folks who were coming to you looking for money for training because they needed employees at that time. So we have both situations that will happen to us, and I am confident that at some point in time we're going to be back in that up economy and needing the workforce out there. And so we need to be able to plan for that in a longer haul, be training people with basic skills so that they can transition to a number of different types of job patterns out there, and not just chase a boom in the economy of a particular sector at a specific time. The development of a long-term program would also be able to do things like tying into the CTE type of program where we're trying to get the high schools back to teaching shop classes and other career technical education skills out there. I think that there's a lot of things that knit into this. So our industries are very supportive of the measure.
Thank you. A quick read of this shows that this would be, in essence, an advisory committee or subcommittee of the board.
Chair Haas, correct. That was how it was designed.
I just have to ask if it was necessary to pass a law to do that.
You know, Chair Haas, members of the committee, that question was raised on the House side as well. Sometimes it takes a legislative push. Sometimes to really make everybody come to the table together and coordinate in a way that is often uncomfortable for people, it takes a little bit of outside pressure. And what I told your counterparts in the House is that not only is this bill that outside pressure, this bill also allows you all to put your fingerprints on it through giving some priorities to this subcommittee while they do their work. When you look at the bill, the whole first page, I believe, is whereases that state some of the goals that we're hoping they work toward. So this bill allows you to put that fingerprint on it and really make sure they're moving in the right direction instead of just going at this on their own, and it gives it that push that we sometimes need to make coordination happen.
Okay. Morris?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I asked the same question when I read the bill. When I read the charge for the Workforce Investment Board, this seems to be the charge of the board, and adding in statute what is already required of the board. I don't get me wrong, I'm 110% in favor of what this is intending to do. But if there's a problem with the board, then fix the board rather than just adding an appendage to the board if you still have a problem within the board. And that would be my comment, Mr. Chair. So I'm a little perplexed why we have to have an advisory committee to do the work of the board. So.
Mr. Chair, do you mind if I respond?
Sure.
Chair Haas, Senator Morse. When I first started working for the AFL-CIO 5 years ago, I was doing some work in with some of our unions and their employers on workforce and training. And at that time, there was a lot of talk about the need to coordinate more what's happening in our workforce system. And it became very clear to me very quickly that OWIB has a lot on their plate. They're given a lot of direction and a lot of tasks, probably more than one board could do, and they have to prioritize within that what they should be doing. There are a lot of interests represented on OWIB, which is a good thing. They have all of the players at the table, but it also means that some of those interests, needs, and wishes for the workforce system don't always align. And I think to tell them through statute that this needs to be a priority and that all of those board members need to come together and figure out where all of our interests align in workforce is important. And given that they have a lot going on and a lot of interests there, it may not happen without something like this.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm understanding you correctly, this actually relates to something that I've been thinking about prior to actually becoming a senator. I've been having some conversations, for example, with Andrew McGough from Work Systems, and thinking about the fact that, for example, there are 80-plus organizations in Washington and Multnomah County alone that do workforce retraining, placement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is it your hope and intention that something like this would work toward consolidating some of those things in some of the ways that are trying to be done, for example, in early childhood? Or I think I appreciate what you're trying to do, but I'm still a little bit unclear about whether the legislation as proposed would actually do what you hope it would do. And I, too, am dubious about adding unnecessary legislation, regardless, you know, even if I agree with the overall intent.
Chair Haas, Senator Steiner Hayward, we're not coming into this bill with an end goal in mind. I don't know that Representative Dembro, whose bill it is, has a specific end goal in mind. And in part, that's because we hope that OWIB can look at the whole system and think about what a good end goal might be, whether that's consolidation or saying that we do have all of the right players and we need those 80-plus organizations, but we need them to work together in a different way, or perhaps saying we need 160 organizations, although I don't think that will be what they ultimately decide. You know, I don't think that there's any one specific end goal. I think the end goal really is taking account of what we have in the system because that hasn't been done in a comprehensive way.
Chair Haas, Senator Hayward, I agree with what Ilana was saying in our discussions with Representative Dembro that I don't think there's a specific outcome of what would be changed exactly out there, but what we do know, and you brought to the exactly to the point, there are so many groups out there trying to head in the right direction. I mean, they're trying to get people out there in the jobs and skills, but we just don't have the coordination level that is needed there. And this has got to become a priority because for groups like my contractor organizations or the unions that I represent, many groups keep coming to us and asking for help. And they're going to go off and do this kind of training or that. And then another group, you know, days later, we will be hit with another request from another group. And it's getting to be very difficult to sort out what should the priorities be because we have limited resources to be able to engage and work with folks out there. And so there needs to be a bigger, better look at this and one that, as we've said earlier, I think the legislature needs to help give a push to on this because there's costs out there to us. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're in a work session. Senator Morse. Make a motion that you see fit.
Well, Mr. Chair, if it's the wish of the committee, let this bill go to the floor for a floor decision. I'm comfortable doing that. However, I certainly reserve the right to oppose the bill on the floor because I just, if there's something wrong with the investment board and they're not doing what their charge is, then we need to fix that. And if that's a fundamental problem, then an advisory committee to something that isn't working may not be the solution either. So, Mr. Chair, I'm not really excited about the bill.
Well, why don't we do this? Why don't we close the public hearing and recess this bill until later on in this afternoon. Okay? Okay?
Sure.
Toria? And we will move on our agenda to open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 4057.
you can give us a summary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4057A moves the submission date for State Board of Higher Education report on retirement plans to Legislative Assembly from October 1st, 2012 to December 1st, 2012.
Thank you. And this is Jack Olson.
Yes.
Jack Isselman.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, Jack Esselman appearing before you on behalf of the Oregon University System. This is a fairly simple measure that's before your committee today. The original contents of this bill were removed in the House Higher Education Committee and replaced with an extension of a deadline that was created in Senate Bill 242 last session, which Chair Haas, you'll recall, as our large piece of higher ed reform. Included in that package of reforms was a creation of two labor management committees, one to look at health and welfare benefits, another to look at retirement benefits across our employment base. I'm pleased to report those labor management committee members have been selected and have commenced their work in earnest. Where we stand today is, although it's only February, summer is approaching, and we will lose some of the participants on that labor management committee to the variability of their contract, which causes them to leave campus for the summer. Accordingly, we are requesting a two-month extension of our October 1st deadline to have the reports of those labor management committee delivered to the legislature. We believe that gives us ample time for drafting of any legislation that would be introduced in the 2013 session, but allows full participation of the membership of those labor management committees. So that's the nature of the measure before you. I could keep testifying till you get a quorum. I'm running out of things to say.
You know, when I was in the TV business, they used to do this is a signal for stretch.
I do believe, I did not check bill tracker, but I believe the bill comes to you unanimously from the House floor.
I do have a question, though, Jack, on how do you, what does the next year shape up to be? I mean, will we be here the following year? I mean, what?
Well, as you may recall, in Senate Bill 242, we were working on so many significant changes to the system. We felt at the time we hadn't really had adequate time to meet with various affected stakeholder groups to talk about changes that might be advisable as we believe as we transition away from agency status to semi-independent status, that there's an opportunity to evaluate a broader range of options, much like we had the risk management discussion and the opportunity to break out of the DAS risk management paradigm. While certainly the two elements are not identical, and risk management we tackled in 242, we felt employee benefits, retirement, and health and welfare were other opportunity areas. But we just, in the process of putting together 242, didn't have an opportunity to talk with stakeholders. So the agreement was made early on that we would establish labor management committees and evaluate this in the interim. So our hope in the two-month extension is just that we'll have a work product that reflects fuller input from all the labor management committee members. Because as I said, some are unable. I believe my understanding is the labor management committee may still continue to meet in the summer months. And of course, you know, employees who aren't under contract are obviously encouraged to come to those meetings, but they won't be getting compensated for that. So the idea was to ensure that those folks who are participating, if they are on a hiatus from participation in the summer months, that we have an opportunity to get their full input in the fall and deliver what we hope will be some consensus recommendations to move forward on in 2013.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Jack. Any questions? Senator Morris, we're in a work session here to move up the date of reporting on this 242 bill, 4057.
4057. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4057A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves House Bill 4057A to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any opposition? Seeing none. House Bill 4057A goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with the due pass recommendation. I'll be the carrier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We have one more bill on our agenda. Why don't we take a 10-minute recess and return and take up that legislation? We are in recess.
Forest Development and open a work session on House Bill 4014A. You'll recall we heard this bill the other day on mandate relief, and some of you may know that we sent over to the House Senate Bill 1540, or Omnibus Education Act. It landed in the House Education Committee, which disbanded with the bill in the committee. So we are going to amend that entire bill into House Bill 4014. And before we do that, I'd like to call Cindy Hunt up here, because even though it passed the Senate floor, 1540, unanimously, I know some questions have been raised on one of the provisions, and I asked her to come up, and this has to do with the reporting requirement, and that is in the amendment here. And Cindy, if you'd be so kind to just explain to us what that means, that it's not the equivalent of lowering the mandatory reporting age from 7 to 5, but
right.
In effect gives districts more leeway with kids who do enroll at that age in kindergarten.
Certainly, Chair Haas, members of the committee, Cindy Hunt, Department of Education, Government and Legal Affairs Manager. So the amendment to House Bill 4014 contains a provision that amends a couple of sections that are relating to Oregon's mandatory attendance law. So currently in Oregon, as you're probably aware, is if you're a child between the ages of 7 and 18, you're required to attend school. If you're the parent of a child between the ages of 7 and 18, you're also required to send the child to school. However, if you're a 5 or a 6-year-old or a parent of a 5 or a 6-year-old, you can choose whether or not to send your child to school. And school districts are obligated to accept 5 and 6-year-olds under the law as well. But currently, if a 5 or a 6-year-old goes to school, they're not required to continue to regularly attend. Because, again, you only have to go to school when you turn 7. So the bill, I believe the intent was to rectify that situation and say that if you're a child that chooses to go when they're 5 or 6, you have to regularly attend. Now, under the bill, the question, like Senator Haas said, has come up around, well, what would be the enforcement if under this? You know, does this apply, you know, is this kind of a backdoor way of applying Oregon's mandatory attendance law to 5 and 6-year-olds? Not exactly, no. Because if you were a parent who chose to send their child to school, a 5 or a 6-year-old, and then the child, you decided, for example, maybe the child wasn't ready or something like that, the bill also leaves intact the exceptions to the mandatory attendance laws. And those exceptions are things like if you homeschool your child, or if you send your child to a private school. Those would be the two that are probably the most relevant exceptions to 5 and 6-year-olds, since they probably don't have a diploma yet. And so homeschooling in this case would be relatively easy in that the main requirement on the parent would be to register the child with the ESD. And what I mean by that, they're not required to test the child until grade 3, so it's probably at about the age of 8 or so. So 5 and 6-year-olds wouldn't be required to be tested, but they would have to register with the ESD. And so I hope that answers your question.
I thank you for putting that on the record. But what I think I heard you say is it's not difficult if a parent decides is his or her child isn't ready after all in kindergarten at age 5, that they can pull back and say, mm-hmm. We decided to go another route.
Correct, Senator Haas. And then most likely they would start to homeschool their child. And there are not, you know, specific requirements on homeschooling a 5 or a 6-year-old other than you have to register them with your local education service district.
Okay. Questions for Cindy on this? Thank you very much. Okay, so with that, we have the A9s, which embodies Senate Bill 1540. Senator Morris.
Mr. Chair, I move the A9 amendments to House Bill 4014.
Senator Morris moves the A9 amendment to House Bill 4014. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. The A9s have been adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
Colleagues, the A15s have been put on your desk, and this deals with the small school funding program, and I would ask for your support. I'd like to make a motion on moving the A15s. Should I make a motion first? Move to adopt the A15s.
Go ahead and discuss your intent. Okay. Why don't you?
As you know, we have a funding problem with small schools around the state of Oregon, especially in Southern Oregon, and how to appropriately fund that program. A15s attempts to strike a compromise. Some of the bigger schools have been complaining that dollars have been taken out of their formula to be sent to these smaller schools. This instead redirects it towards ESDs, and it's a compromise. It gets us continue the program and gets us to the next session to figure out how to deal with it on a bigger issue. So I would ask for support on the A15s. Can I make a motion?
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I move that the A15s be adopted into House Bill 4014.
Mr. Chair, I have a motion here. Senator George has moved that the A15s be amended into House Bill 44.
If I might, Mr. Chair, I realize we're in work session, but I believe we would have time, because this is a fairly substantive issue for ESDs. There may be persons in the audience that would wish to speak to this issue.
I'll meet you, the superintendent.
And if it would be possible to allow that before we vote on the amendment.
It would be. Who do you have in mind?
Well, I think we have Susan Waddell from superintendent of the Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD, which happens to be in my district.
Ms. Waddell,
she may have some thoughts.
Would that be okay if you came up?
Ozzie Rose may have some comments.
Well, why don't we take Susan Waddell first?
Chair Haas, committee, thank you for allowing me to speak. I'm Susan Waddell. I'm the superintendent for the Lynn Benton Lincoln Education Service District. We're located in Albany, and Senator Morris is our senator. I would like to oppose any further reduction to ESD funding. Our districts already have taken substantial reduction in service that the ESD provides because of prior reductions. This additional reduction in funding for ESDs would result in several hundreds of thousands of dollars for our ESD in services such as physical therapy, speech-language services, and many required services to the districts. If we don't provide them, we'll have to find another way to fund. So it's a real cost shift to our districts. Our districts need to provide those services, and they find that through the ESD, it is the most efficient way to provide those services. So any further reduction impacts our districts, large and small.
I apologize. I'm brand new.
Okay.
And I get to use that for about another week. but I'm going to use it. Are you opposing or supporting this amendment?
I'm opposing this amendment.
You're opposing the amendment.
I'm opposing the amendment because it reduces
funding to the ESDs.
Funding. Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Senator Meyer?
I guess question, the schools that would be most harmed would be the small schools if they lost, because they're the ones who are responsible for providing the services. Is that correct?
Chair House, Senator Beyer, yes.
But they got this additional money. I suppose they could use that to buy those services from you.
Chair House, Senator Beyer, currently they do receive the small schools, high school correction, and then this would be an additional reduction in their resolution services through the ESD. They're already using the small schools correction money to fund services, and by not providing the small schools correction, that would be a reduction in funding.
Mr. Chair, maybe I'm confused. I thought this was a refunding of the small school thing, that they would lose, without this, they would lose the small school funding.
Well, it's in the same amendment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, perhaps I can clarify. Currently, the way we fund that program is a reduction in the school formula for all schools.
Right.
That's drawn some criticism, and so instead, the same amount of money is basically taken from all the ESDs to do the same exact project. So do you take it out of the school formula, or do you take it out of the ESDs? And that's the tough choice we have.
Mr. Chair.
To be clear, they won't get both.
Correct.
To restate it again, it's a continuation of a historic funding formula, but it comes from a different source. Instead of the broad-based state school fund, which is distributed education statewide for all schools, it will come specifically out of the ESD appropriation. That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator Byer?
I'm still confused.
Me too.
If
I feel
we
better.
Don't, let me be real clear. I know how it has been funded. If we do not adopt the A15s, they will still get the money. It will just come from the funding formula.
This grant sunsets in.
Okay, so if we don't pass this, they will lose that funding. Correct. In the next fiscal year.
Correct.
So it's in the 12-13 pass year. This and take it from the ESDs, or the school districts don't get funding.
Correct.
The small schools.
Yes. Under this grant. Ms. Waddell, we thank you for your testimony, for your hard work. We are down to bad choices in this budget and in this economy.
I understand that, but we continue to take hits from ESDs, which really are hitting school districts and the services that are so needed by special ed kids as well as regular ed kids.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. It's the latest iteration of my name. It's all good. I guess my challenge right now is this. If I clearly understand the hit that small schools are going to take if we don't continue this grant funding to them. That being said, I represent parts of Portland and Beaverton, which are the two biggest districts in the state. Beaverton isn't quite the second biggest, but it's close. And our district, Beaverton, is facing a $40 million budget shortfall. And Portland is just as bad. And I guess if I think about what the ESDs provide on a scale model, I'd be reluctant to cut their funding, too, because I think they're providing core services to a lot of these smaller schools, too. So I'm not sure that it's not just robbing Peter to pay Paul. I'm struggling because I certainly support the small schools across our state, but I'm not sure this is a good fix for this problem. As you said, we're down to bad choices, but I'm just trying to be clear about what I'm struggling with right now.
Okay. Well, we have a motion for the Dash 15 amendments. Further discussion on the motion? We're on the Dash 15s, and we'll take a roll call vote.
Senator Byer?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
No.
Vice Chair Morse?
No.
Chair Hass?
Yes. Measure passes. The amendment is adopted. Senator Morse, you want to make a motion?
We need to suspend rules. We don't have this business.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on House Bill 4014A without having the fiscal impact and revenue impact statements on hand at this time.
Senator Morris moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on House Bill 4014A without having the fiscal impact and revenue impact statements on hand at this time. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4014A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves House Bill 4014A. Due pass recommendation
to the floor of the Oregon State Senate. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none, House Bill 4014 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate. I'll be the carrier. Close the work session and public hearing on 4014. And I want to reopen the public hearing and work session on House Bill 4141, Representative Denbrough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate colleagues, Michael Denbrough, State Representative for House District 45, that's Northeast Portland, out to Park Rose. I'm sorry I wasn't able to be here when the bill was first presented. We're having a heck of a time over in Ways and Means Sub. But I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. But let me preface those with some comments about this bill. This is a bill that we've been working on in the House Committee on Higher Education with the governor's new workforce policy advisor in an effort to try to bring the various funding streams in the state into alignment. You know, the state invests a lot in workforce development. Most of the funding for these programs actually comes from federal sources in a number of different streams. And if I were to ask you, you know, just how much does the state invest in workforce development, I'm sure none of you could answer that. And I'm sure there's no one in the state that could answer that. And that, I submit to you, is a problem. If I were further to ask you what we are getting for this investment in terms of the number of individuals who are able to move from training into employment in the areas that they're being trained in, that too is an unknown at this point. And we really need to have answers to those questions. And we need to bring those different funding streams into alignment. Right now, we're seeing a fair amount of disconnect between our community colleges, our labor unions, and our local workforce investment boards. We need to get them working together. So we need to make the overall system more accountable, but also more aligned. And that's what this bill is seeking to do. We believe that at the end of the day, it's going to require some legislation. And at the end of the day, it's probably going to involve some federal waiver requests. And this bill creates the process for doing that. It directs the Oregon Workforce Investment Board to either constitute a subcommittee or working as a committee as a whole examine the issues that are laid out in the bill, which I think if you look at them, those are key questions, really, that need to be addressed. And this bill will create the framework for those conversations to happen with, you know, the hammer of a legislative directive that I think if you look at the history of this area, you will agree is needed. And that's why we developed this legislation and why I bring it to you. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Bart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'm a little bit fuddled by this. The federal law that creates the Workforce Investment Board. It's existed for a number of years. In fact, it's probably existed all the way back to the early 1970s when I was running these kinds of programs. Requires them to do exactly what you're saying this law requires. If they weren't doing it based on the laws that have existed for almost 40 years, given the funding requires them to do that, what will this get done in the next 6 months?
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, you know, I think that in part, again, we have the issue of separate, parallel, and uncoordinated funding streams. so that each individual funding stream may have its own accountability metrics, whether it's in the local workforce investment boards or in the community colleges or through union apprenticeship programs. But they're not coordinated, and so you can't get single answers to those questions, and so the next step will be to get a full coordination of the system as far as accountability measures go.
Thank you, Chair Hass. Representative Demarest, thank you for bringing this to our attention. Mm-hmm. And I want to be clear, I said this before when you weren't in the room. I completely support the intention of this bill. I've actually been having some interesting conversations with Andrew McGough from Work Systems about exactly this problem.
Yes.
That being said, if you look at ORS, I just want to go back to what Senator Byers said. ORS 663.24, I can't read all the subsections well enough, but I think it's sub 5, says the board shall provide guidance and direction to local workforce investment boards in the development of local workforce plans. The state workforce investment board shall adopt policies that A, require each local workforce investment board in partnership with its chief officers in accordance with the federal act to develop and submit to the governor and the board a strategic local workforce plan that includes but is not limited to performance goals, which sounds like not an individual program performance goals, but actually the local workforce investment board. And it to determine, just to skip down a little bit, consistent with the requirements of the Federal Act, the appropriate level of services based on the workforce needs in the local workforce investment area. So I guess I'm still really confused. I understand your intention, and I agree with you. I mean, I commented about the number of programs in Washington and Multnomah County alone that provide these services, but I still don't quite get why you think this bill will get them to do something that they're already supposed to be doing. Bear in mind, I'm on your side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, as I said before, sorry, Mr. Chair and Senator Steiner Hayward, what this bill does is, you know, first of all, it expresses a clear message from the legislature. It delineates a clear timeline for action to be taken on this. And it expects a certain set of results. And there is a clear sense among many people who are involved in these areas or who touch upon these areas that this is exactly what's needed at this time. We had a long hearing on this subject, in the policy committee on the other side, and we heard testimony after testimony about this. And, that's what the bill passed out unanimously, passed on the floor of the House unanimously. We really got the clear message that this is something that was needed. I apologize if I didn't prepare better for this particular hearing. For perhaps making some assumptions about the case haven't been made. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
With your permission, thank you. I get what you're saying, but now I'm confused because when I look at the engrossed version of this bill, Section 1, Sub 1A says, may develop initiatives related to workforce development, including potential proposed legislation that may be introduced during the 2013 regular session. That doesn't sound like a very definitive timeline or direction to me. That sounds like a lot of qualifiers that's not going to be what I would consider very pushy language.
Mm-hmm.
I'm admitting I'm a newbie.
Right. Mr. Chair and Senator Steiner Hayward. It may be that as the work is done on this, that solutions can be found that don't require legislation. And if that's the case, great. I would be the first person to, you know, support that. If it can be done without seeking federal waivers, great, because that can be a difficult process. And that's why we have the permissive language in there, because we don't want legislation created which is not needed. That would be counterproductive. But the intent is very clearly that a year from now we should be in a position where we're either taking definitive legislative steps or we have found ways to come up with answers to those questions. Looking at our workforce development system globally, how much is going in, how is the money being spent in totality, and what are we getting for it? That's the goal here.
Senator Morse. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the work on this. It sounds to me, I've not been involved in it, but it just sounds to me like that there are some things that have been left unaddressed. And I'm wondering, is this bill a workaround for the board that's not doing their job? Because it would seem to me that the board would have the authority to, and should, not just have, we know we have the authority, but they should exercise it to do, to accomplish the same things that you're wanting this to be done by statute. So it just appears to be a workaround for something, for a board that's not discharging its responsibilities.
Senator Morse, I think that's a very good point. And I sit on the board. I'm a newly appointed member of the board. And I have interfaced with it for a number of years through my work on the State Board of Education and as a community college instructor. And I believe that the board is very well-intentioned and has done a lot of good work. But I also believe that the directives that are included in the bill would be useful for the board.
Well, Representative, you're on that board then, so it may be possible for you to assert this intent as a member, as one way to do it. I think you were out of the room when we had some of this discussion, but we do not yet have consensus in this committee to move forward. I do think it's very possible, though, that every one of us will sign a letter to the governor, which may do the very same thing. And if I can twist arms here, but we don't have consensus yet. Okay, so this is our last day of this, and you know the ramifications of a short session. And So I think we're happy to sign on to a letter like that. And Senator Morse?
Yeah, if I might make a suggestion that we craft a letter from this committee and co-authored with the House committee that identifies specifically what we'd like to have done and kind of a get your butt in gear, excuse me, for the expression to look at these issues within the context of the existing board and do it by virtue of a letter that we all sign on, I think we would on this committee and hopefully on the House committee. And would that move the ball?
It would certainly move it farther than not sending the letter, Senator Morse. Yes, no, I'm being facetious. Yes, that would be very helpful, I think, especially if it included the various charges that are included in the bill, you know, that we need the board to be working on. That I think would be useful.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your work on this.
Great. So we'll work with you on the drafting of the letter.
Okay.
We'll get our administrator to talk to your administrator.
That'd be easy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to close the hearing and work session on 4141. Yes.
Senator Steiner Hayward, we need to suspend the rules for you to vote on 4057.
Oh.
So we need a rule suspension for purposes of allowing Senator Steiner Hayward to vote on 4057.
Mr. Chair, I move to suspend the rules to allow Senator Steiner Hayward to vote on House Bill 4057.
Senator Morris moves to suspend the rules to allow Senator Steiner Hayward to vote on House Bill 4057. Objections? Seeing none. Senator Steiner Hayward, how do you vote?
Aye.
She votes aye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, committee, for this session and your diligence, studiousness, and patience. We are adjourned.